There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. So glad that you could join me once again in this rather convenient distraction from all the nonsense and madness that is going on in our world and certainly in our nation nowadays. Yes, when you come to Wax Ecstatic, you experience a different madness altogether now. But no, we're not going to be mad at all during this podcast because we've got a pretty fun set to look back at, part of our early 90s look at the early 90s Donruss sets, I should say. And this was a set that I remember fondly for a number of reasons. One, because it's from my favorite year of being a collector, which was 1993. Which was also a year that was my last year as a collector of all things new baseball cards, 1993. If you've listened to any of the past episodes about 1993 or even the 94 Tops episode we did not too long ago, you'll get the backstory on that. Just a lot of things came together as I, the tender young, how old was I, 15-year-old, experiencing the changes that a lot of 15-year-olds go through, accompanied by a strike in Major League Baseball that kind of altered my collecting plans for quite a while, as I didn't really collect anything new for a good 10 or 12 years. But I still have a lot of great memories of collecting brand new baseball cards in 1993. They were neat. They were informative. They were still, even though the prices were going up, still somewhat affordable for 15-year-olds whose primary source of income was mowing the neighbor's yard. And it was another great effort by Donruss to not only raise the standard Donruss flagship brand, but to keep the rest of the competition raising their standards as well. It was an arms race to not be overlooked and ignored. That's what was happening with the factory-based sets in the early 1990s, and 1993 Donruss is definitely one of those sets that is a fine-looking set. It's actually, in some ways, improved from the huge leap forward that Donruss made in 1992. The downside, as with many sets from the early 1990s, A, there's too many of them. B, there's not enough major rookie cards or special insert cards that make it a great investment set. But if you're looking to make an investment off 93 Donruss, you're doing it wrong. And C, because there are so many of them and because they're not a great investment set, if you will, they do kind of get lost in the shuffle of all the other cards that were being made then. But the benefits of that, and this tends to be the case with almost all of the sets that came out around 92, 93, 94, is that if you're just itching for some 90s nostalgia and you want to throw it back to the good old days when you were a teenager or slightly older or slightly younger in 1993, and you want to do it without breaking the bank, well, guess what? 93 Donruss is probably the best example of a set that you can get that will not drain your bank account and definitely lives up to the reputation of you're probably going to pay more for shipping than the actual cards themselves. And I will provide some examples for you a little later on. Plus, we've got four players from the two packs that I opened, and the video break is on YouTube. Just type in Wax Ecstatic 1993 Donruss Pack Break, and you'll see what we pulled out. The biggest card that we got, the biggest name, Tony Gwynn, but some other notable names in there as well. Dennis Martinez, Travis Fryman was another one. But in the two packs that we opened up, the 28 cards that were there, I found some players, random pulls again, players that I don't believe I've talked about before in this program. And I always love sharing the stories of some of the players on these cards, because there are some players that you know full well about. Like one of the players that we're going to talk about, Pat Borders. Chances are you know much of the Pat Borders story, mostly because he was in baseball for eternity. He played 24 seasons, and you probably know a little bit about Pat Borders, but you may not know much about the backstory of how he fought to get into the major leagues. But we've got another story that a common card is not involving a common person. And in fact, I'd say two cards that kind of fit that. One, kind of following the same path that Kevin Moss followed in, although this player and his card was not anywhere near as popular as Kevin Moss was back in the early 90s. But another player who, when I opened the pack and I saw his card, and you'll see this on the video, I said, you know, oh, he's really one of the most underrated pitchers, underrated relief pitchers of the early 90s. And I'll tell you who it is. It's Mike Henneman, who at the time was a reliever for the Detroit Tigers. And while I was doing a little research on Mike Henneman, because I was just basing my comment off of my memories as a Toronto Blue Jays fan in the early 90s, the Detroit Tigers were still a contending team then. And Henneman was just one of those guys where if it was a tight game, like let's say you're at Tiger Stadium, Blue Jays are up 3-2, seventh inning, in comes Henneman. You weren't getting much off of him. He was a pretty dominant pitcher. And that memory sparked me to go, okay, this is a guy that we've got to tell a story about. Well, not only did I pull some statistics that basically backed up my just general memory from 30 years ago that this guy was pretty decent, but there is an incredible backstory that has only recently, and I mean within the last couple of years, has only recently emerged in the story of Mike Henneman, in that he recently discovered a side of his family that he never knew existed. And it's a remarkable story. And I'm looking forward to sharing that with you near the tail end of the podcast. So make sure you stick around for that. Now, I would like to thank you again for joining me as we look at 93 Donruss this week. What's coming up on the next few shows? Well, our next podcast, which will be 2 weeks from today, that's Friday, January 29th. We're going to take a look at a very unique set from the early 1990s, and it actually got a start in 1989 with a test set, and it went public in 1990, but it lasted only 1 year. And I believe this was a victim to a couple of things. One, the economy at the time, again, the American economy was in a recession mode in 1990, 1991. So there were a lot of these little side projects that Topps in particular decided to shelve. And that includes, you know, what we call the Topps UK minis, or as I prefer, the Topps Europe set. This was one of those little side projects that got pushed way off to the side. Never mind the back burner. It went right back into the cabinet. But not only because of the recession, but also because there was so much pressure for Topps and really all baseball card manufacturers in the early 1990s to improve base sets, to dominate on the premium sides, to really consolidate all efforts into pushing two or three particular sets as opposed to maybe eight or nine different products. And I think this is one of those products that fell by the wayside. And it does kind of live on in a completely different product that came out about 15 years ago. I'm talking about the Topps Heads Up collection. Now, that's not to be confused with the Gaudy Heads Up baseball cards of the 1930s. The Topps Heads Up were basically miniature, roughly 5-inch by 3-inch cardboard cutouts of the heads of famous baseball players at that time. And it was designed basically for, you know, the 10, 11, 12-year-old boy who, if you opened up the pack and you got this giant Ken Griffey Jr. head, not to be confused with the giant Ken Griffey Jr. head of Homer at the Bat fame from that 1992 episode of The Simpsons. But if you had this Ken Griffey Jr. head and you were a big Ken Griffey Jr. or Seattle Mariners fan, then the idea was that you would attach the head to the suction cup that came in the pack, or there were some adhesive strips on the back. You would just peel them off and stick it to your bedroom wall or whatever. That's who it was marketed to. I did not even know that this product existed until I found it on eBay several weeks ago. So I purchased three of them, and we'll open them up. I don't know if I'll have player biographies, because we all kind of know who Ken Griffey Jr. and some of the other players are. But I do want to dive into this pretty unique product and, again, kind of reset how the hobby and the economy and collecting habits of the early 1990s were changing, and how this really cool idea that Topps came up with in 1989, by 1991 was passé to the point where Topps didn't even make it. So we'll be taking a look at the unique Topps Heads Up collection in our next podcast. Again, that is January 29th. 2 weeks after that, we will complete our hat trick of Donruss baseball sets from the early 1990s. We'll take a look at 1994, some of the pros and cons of that set. And then what comes after that? Well, I've had some interesting suggestions along the way. I may be doing a little eBay shopping in the next couple weeks to see what interesting stuff I can find. But one thing that I will take a look at, and again, I want to thank one of our listeners for chiming in on this, I believe, through an email, and that is looking at update sets. And I do have one update set still in its original box. It is a little worse for wear because over the last 30 years, I've taken the cards out of the box, looked at them, put them back in, so there's a little wear and tear. That is the 1987 Topps traded set. But there is a lot of history behind the traded set. And what started as just not even as an insert, it was first part of the base set. Then it became an insert to replace a card in the base set. And then it became an extension of the base set. And then it became its own set. There's a lot of interesting history in not only Topps traded, but the subsets that would come out from competitors in later years. That, of course, would be Fleer Update, also Upper Deck High Numbers, Donruss The Rookies set. So we'll dive into the traded slash update slash high series sets that started coming out, again, in the early 70s. That's where it really started, in 1972. But as it grew into a thing by the early 80s, it became a key attachment to whatever collection you had, a little accessorizing, if you will, in the early 90s, and it is still very much a part of the hobby today. So I don't know if that will necessarily follow the 1994 Donruss discussion we have in February, but it is definitely on my radar. And as I said, I'll be doing some shopping pretty soon, so who knows what else will pop up. Maybe we'll swing back a little bit into the 70s and 80s with one of our shows. Maybe I'll find something truly bizarro, kind of like the Topps Heads Up, that we want to share. But we will cross that bridge when we get there. Now, one reason why I'm able to go shopping, we've had some cash donations recently. Thank you so much to fans who have made donations over the last few weeks. Again, cash donations can be made at paypal.me/waxecstatic. That's paypal.me/waxecstatic. And even if it's a donation of, say, $5, that goes a long way on this program, not only because it helps us pay Audioboom to host the podcast and deliver it on the RSS feed to all of the podcast platforms that carry the program, but also it helps us buy the products that we discuss on the show. And as a reminder, excess product, that goes to the fine folks at Commons for Kids, as we like to make the donations of those extra packs, those extra cards we pull from, say, rack packs and boxes that we do occasionally buy. We like to pass it along to those great people who are doing an awesome service, sending not just baseball cards or sports cards, but non-sports cards as well to kids who just need a pleasant distraction from their lives. I just don't mean that as like kids who are bored. We're talking kids who are dealing with medical conditions, kids who are in a bad home situation, maybe a bad economic situation. And, you know, nothing makes kids happier than something that takes their mind off of that stuff. And if there's a kid who likes a particular sport, a particular team, a particular player, they can get that relief from the nonsense going on in their lives with Commons for Kids. Now, if you would like to make a donation to Commons for Kids, follow them on Twitter, Commons for Kids. That's the number four. You'll see information on what they're looking for, where you can send cards to. And while it is an easy and convenient way to drop off some of the unwanted junk wax that you may have, please do send them some current stuff. Maybe send them some vintage stuff that's in decent shape as well. And don't just send them the Commons. Go ahead, break off some star cards, rookie cards. How many 87 Tops Bo Jacksons do you need? If you've got a couple of them, throw them in there. Send them to Commons for Kids. I'm sure they will greatly appreciate all of your donations, much like we appreciate yours. And don't forget, you can make cardboard donations as well. Email me, Matt Salmon Says, that's MattSammonSez, @gmail.com. Let me know what you're thinking, if it's something that we can use on the show, or what the hell? You just have some cards you want to get rid of. You feel like you want to put them in my own personal collection. That's great, too. We can work something out. And I appreciate all help coming that way. And by the way, I appreciate all donations or people who have inquired about donating from their own collection, some of the cards that I need to finish my own personal collections. I'm still chipping away. 84, 85, 86 Tops. I'm getting there. 77, getting close. 76, I'm inching a little closer. But I do appreciate people who have inquired about helping out or who've been able to find a few of those cards and have sent them my way. Now, one note from one of our cash donations from the last couple of weeks, Roy Carlson. Thank you for your donation, Roy. He mentions our previous episode, which was all about the 1991 Topps Archive set. And he said in the comments, along with the PayPal payment, listen to your very interesting 1991 Topps Archive show. Love that classic Topps 1953 set. You inspire me to pick up an Archives hand-collated set on eBay. Love your shows. Keep them coming, Matt, Roy. Well, thank you again, Roy, not only for the donation, but for the very kind thoughts. And, you know, while the donation is a good thing to keep the show plugging along here, and we're super happy about that, I love knowing that I was able to inspire someone to take a look at a set that's going to get overlooked because it falls in that junk wax era. It's from the early 90s. But as is a common theme of a lot of these early 90s set, because there are so many of them still out there, and a lot of people just kind of shrug off early 90s sets these days because there's not a lot of monetary return that you get in them. If you're just looking for fun sets to collect, early 90s is where it's at. And late 80s too, but definitely early 90s is the hobby was just bulging beyond its seams. And it was kind of heading down the wrong direction with inserts and refractors and everything else that alienated a lot of collectors. Nowadays, if you just, again, want that 90s nostalgia, now's the time to go back and do it. So, Roy, I'm glad that I was able to kind of reintroduce the 91 Topps Archive set and glad that I could entertain you as well along the way. Now, we also have our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. A few comments here that I want to pass along before we look back at 93 Donruss. One from our friend John Grochalski mentioning a Saber Baseball Cards tweet from, when was this? Looks like it was January 6th or 7th. Happy Saber Baseball Cards birthday to three-time All-Star Ralph Branca and this is a great note here, as the back of his 1952 Bowman card reminds us, quote, experts agree that nothing was wrong with the pitch, which is absolutely right. Of course, responding to the pitch that Branca threw to Bobby Thompson in that final playoff game that helped the Giants win the National League pennant. The shot heard round the world October 3rd, 1951. And, of course, experts agree there was nothing wrong with the pitch. The same could be said for the guys in the Giants clubhouse at the Polo Grounds stealing the Dodgers signs. But I digress. John says between this and the latest Wax Ecstatic, it's Ralph Branca week for me. Well, we're glad that we could provide some entertainment Ralph Branca style for you. Molly McKinley chiming in. I just discovered your show and I'm loving it, learning a lot about things I didn't know before. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Molly. And, you know, again, just being able to kind of introduce some sets or reintroduce some sets or tell some player stories is always fun for me. And it's rewarding to see that somebody's getting entertained by it. Last but not least, Golden Hurricane Card Sales sharing an interesting set from 1993 called Ruthian Shots. And Golden Hurricane Card Sales says, I may have just found out or found my new favorite set. And it's a collection of Babe Ruth photographs, which is really, really cool. So thank you so much for sharing that with us as well. Wax and Gum Stains is open 24/7. So jump on board the old twitter.com machine and share your thoughts about our podcast, about the players we talk about, the sets we talk about. I also take show comments, suggestions, ideas, criticisms, whatever. Throw it up there. And our last bit of housekeeping, just a reminder, if you're listening to this program on a platform that allows you to rate and review the podcast, please do so. We certainly appreciate all positive reviews. It certainly helps us get bumped up the algorithm a little bit, certainly on Apple Podcasts, but on other platforms. So positive reviews are appreciated and negative reviews will be mocked. Now, there's nothing to mock about the 1993 Donruss set. As we talked about a few weeks ago, the 1992 set was a much-needed course correction for Donruss, which had really sadly lost its way after having some great sets in the mid to late 80s. 1990, you had the absolute clown car set that we've discussed before. And then in 1991, you had a set that was very contemporary in its design, still very set in the old Donruss ways and some other elements. But on the grand scheme of things, nothing to really brag about. The 91 Donruss set, while cool in 1991, looks very tacky and just not really all that exciting to get into 30 years later. Definitely not memorable or in any kind of good way is it memorable. And even though 91 Donruss was a set that I loved back in the day, you know, there's no emotional attachment to it now. You can give me a handful of 91 Donruss packs. I'll open them. I'll look at them. But nothing inside them make me go, yeah, I want to keep this or I want to build on this or anything like that. So, you know, the 1992 Donruss set was a much needed correction, not only upping the standards of the set, better card stock, great photography, the gloss on the set, the, you know, the counterfeit proofing measures, not only in the packaging, but the watermark on the back of the card, the first major overhaul that Donruss had on the back of cards since 1982. And there were a lot of things going on with it, but the 92 Donruss set had to be completely reimagined or else Donruss was going to fall down a very, very dark rabbit hole very quickly. Well, 1993 comes along, and Donruss actually manages to make the set better. And I think that's one of the tragedies of these early 90s sets is that there are some that are incredibly well-made, well-produced, striking art, great photography, good inserts, even though the insert craze was starting to get out of control. But because it all kind of gets lumped into that quote-unquote junk wax era, people just don't even think twice about it. But when you take a good close look at 93 Donruss, how they took a very, very good step forward from 1992 and made it even better, is really impressive. It's a 792 card set, unlike the 92 set, which was 792 cards, but broken up in two series of unequal numbers. Donruss did it the right way this time around, as they broke the set down into two series of 396 cards each. Very similarly structured to how the 92 set was, and that was Diamond Kings, the now glossy Perez Steel artwork cards that for many years was the first 27 cards in the Donruss set. Well, that was continued as an insert, a premium insert, in some very damn fine cards as well, as was the situation in 1992. And you also had a few more inserts like Legends of the Game and, you know, just a few extra bells and whistles here and there. That was just part of what was going on back then, just more and more inserts, including autographed inserts. So now it's not just an insert, it's a chase card. Now you're trying to buy boxes and boxes of these cards for a chance to get, say, a Will Clark autographed card. And then you also had the Rated Rookies subset, which was still part of the base set. So, you could still do your rookie chase there without having to deviate too far from the standard hobby or retail product. And again, structurally, pretty much the same. Now, Series 2 is heavily weighted towards the new teams that year, the Florida Marlins and the Colorado Rockies, as expected. That's similar to how Topps handled it as well. So you could see the players in their new uniforms. When did Series 2 come out? Probably around May or June of that year. And that was a big deal. And I mentioned this in the video break. You know, people, and I always come back to this. I'm soon going to be one of those parents on the Progressive Insurance Company commercials where, the guy is the motivational speaker is telling you how not to behave like your parents. So I'm soon going to be one of those guys who completely, sets every story to back before the internet was around. and I'm going to have that motivational speaker like smack me or something. But again, for context, back before the internet was a thing, and it was slowly becoming a thing in 1993. But again, most households didn't really have it until, say, 95 or 96. But, that was the way that you saw new uniforms, new teams, new logos. You found out through baseball cards. Or, maybe there was a highlight on SportsCenter. Maybe there was an article written up about one of these teams in Sports Illustrated or the Sporting News, one of those publications. But for me, it was baseball cards. That was my first source for some of this information. So 1993 was not only how I got to see the Marlins and Rockies, their first baseball cards, but that's also how I learned of logo changes for the Seattle Mariners, which is interesting because there were preview cards of the 93 Donruss set released late in 1992, and one of the preview cards was Ken Griffey Jr., but it still featured the old blue and gold Seattle Mariners logo. Well, by 1993, they had moved on to the more nautical-looking gray S with the aqua and the salmon compass behind it. And they've had that look ever since 1993. Every now and then they dabble back into a little blue and gold, kind of their Sunday uniforms, if you will. But, that's how I learned about the Seattle Mariners changing their logo. That's how I learned about the California Angels changing their logo. What's interesting about the Angels logo of 1993, we talk about 90s nostalgia and how a lot of organizations are going back to the designs of the 80s and 90s. And it's not just sports. You're seeing it in consumer products as well. Pizza Hut, Burger King recently rebranding with, kind of a 70s look to a lot of their products. Well, it's not just now. I've told you before, this comes in cycles. It's generational. Well, in the early 1990s, the California Angels in 1993 basically dialed back their look to a slightly modernized version of their uniform and logo from 1965 to 1970, which I thought was cool. The one thing they forgot to do was bring the halo back to the top of their hats. I wish the Angels would do that now. Bring the the halo stitching back to the top of their hats. That was the coolest thing about those mid to late 60s California Angels jerseys. But, you know, that's how I learned about the logo changes, team color changes, and of course you would actually see those jersey changes for the appropriate teams in Series 2. So structurally, the 93 Donruss set pretty much the same as 92. Where the biggest difference was on the back of the card, where Donruss suddenly went from a very busy back of the card to looking like something that Upper Deck would make. In fact, if you get a 93 Donruss card and a 93 Upper Deck card, turn them over. Turn those cards over and look at the backs, and you will see that they are practically coming out of the same design book. It's almost like the same person just copied and pasted the design elements to the backs of the cards, which is actually a great thing for Donruss, because even though the redesign of the back of the cards in 1992 was much needed and really good looking, as I mentioned in that podcast, one of the downsides was with the black text, if there was a player wearing a dark uniform, such as the Minnesota Twins dark blue or the Chicago White Sox black uniforms, you kind of lost some of the text in the gradient phasing out of the picture. And it became a little hard to read. Plus, it made the back of the card really, really busy, where they just kind of stuck this, you know, somewhat cheesecloth picture of the player right in the middle of all the stats and other information. So while it was an upgrade, it was busy. While in 1993, it was an upgrade that made it look nice and clean and organized. Roughly 2/3 of the card is devoted to an action photo of the player, a color action photo of the player. Then you have beneath it the recent major league stats, any other personal notes or trivia if they were able to fit it in there. And that was it. The front of the cards, again, an upgrade from 1992. We talked about how the 92 Donruss set was very clean. It was devoted mostly to the photo. There was a white frame around it. But other than just kind of this cold blue bar down at the bottom with the player's name, team name, and position, that was about it. Well, in 93, Donruss dresses it up a little bit, yet simplifies it. Once again, slight white border around the front. You've got a full color photograph there as well. Some great photography too, as we'll get into. And the player name is again featured on a single color bar. The big difference, not having the team name spelled out, Donruss actually used the logo of the team on the card. So some subtle changes, but generally speaking on the front, pretty much the same as 1992. Whereas in 1993, the back of the car, definitely an upgrade from what Donruss had already upgraded in 1992. So you've got a great looking set. You've got an incredible assortment of players. And this is what really makes me enjoy looking back at some of the card sets from the late 80s and early 90s. You've got this incredible mashup of players from the 1970s and 80s. And, you know, if you want to be honest, when you're talking Nolan Ryan, you know, 1960s, you know, in one case. But you've got Nolan Ryan, George Brett, Robin Yount, Paul Molitor, Jack Morris, Dale Murphy. You've got all of these guys that, you know, became stars in the 1970s who were still very relevant and outstanding players in the early 1990s. Dave Winfield, another one. You know, there's just so many of those. But then at the same time, you've got the young stars of the early 1990s. You've got Ken Griffey Jr. You've got Frank Thomas. You've got Jose Canseco and Mark McGwire. And oh, by the way, you still have the stars of the 80s. Tony Gwynn, like I said, we pulled from that pack. You've got Ryan Sandberg and Cal Ripken Jr. and Ricky Henderson and Wade Boggs and Roger Clemens and Dwight Gooden, Barry Bonds. My goodness, we were all so fortunate to be able to watch these players either in person or on television in their prime. It's incredible. And even at 792 cards, think about it, just some of that star power. Now let's add to it. 1993 Donruss, you also have Chipper Jones. You also have Mike Piazza. You also have, you know, some of the young stars that would become dominant in the early 90s. Greg Maddux, Tom Glavine, John Smoltz, Robbie Alomar, just so many incredible players. And it's all in this set. And again, it's not just Donruss, really. Any set from 1993, you can find these players for the most part. Now, you have some sets, like Topps had Derek Jeter in the 1993 set. So that bumps up Topps' value. It's a little harder to find the Topps cards now. Donruss did not have the Derek Jeter cards. That's maybe one knock against it. But really, the assortment of young stars, emerging stars, established stars, certain Hall of Fame players all in one set. It's just a phenomenal collection that you can find in 93 Donruss. So where can I get this set, Matt, you're asking? How much do I have to shell out to either buy a factory set or a hand collated set or a couple of boxes? I'll assemble it myself. Here's the great news. Not a whole lot. In fact, 93 Donruss, despite all of these great factors to it, it is a bargain bin beauty. And some people see it as a downside. Oh, these cards aren't worth that much. Again, if you are buying 1993 Donruss for some kind of price tag value to it, you're doing it wrong. Okay. Nobody is going to get rich quick off of 1990s baseball cards. Period. All right. Unless you've got that somewhat rare PSA 10 Derek Jeter rookie or Chipper Jones rookie, maybe a handful of other players from that time, it's just not there. But if that's your main motivation, you're doing it wrong. Go play the stock market. That's still pretty high nowadays. You're not going to make that money, like you would on the stock market if you're going into baseball cards here. So if you're collecting 93 Donruss, it's because you're scratching that 90s nostalgia itch. It's because you're like me. You know, maybe you got rid of those 93 Donruss cards 10, 15, 20 years ago. In your anger, you went, screw these cards. It's not worth it. Tired of carrying them around. I did. Now, am I motivated to build a 93 Donruss set? No, it's kind of like 92 Donruss. Doesn't light my fire right now. I'm focused on some of those earlier top sets I was telling you about. But if you're looking to scratch that 90s nostalgia itch, looking for something fun to do while you're in a quarantine, or you're just passing some time away, it's still winter, you know, still cold and gray in a lot of areas, and you're stuck indoors, may I suggest 93 Donruss, because you will get that great assortment of players. You'll get that, fine quality card. And oh yeah, you may get one of those chase cards as well. That's kind of gravy to me. It's the added bonus, getting those Diamond Kings cards, getting perhaps one of those insert cards that were in supply in limited numbers. So you could go looking for those. But generally speaking, you're going to be able to put together a pretty cheap set that does not look cheap at all. Now, I've seen boxes, Series 1 boxes, going for as little as $10. Series 2, 15 to 20, only because that's where Chipper Jones is. And that's a hell of a bargain. You know, again, you're probably going to pay more for shipping than the actual product itself. Case in point, too, I saw on eBay somebody with a hand collated Series 1 1993 Donruss set. $1.99. The shipping is $12. The cards themselves, $1.99. So instead of buying that box of Series 1 for $10, spend $2. Somebody already did all the work for you. The shipping's going to be roughly the same. So you can get some bargains there. I'm sure you can still find some factory sets that are still out there that are sealed and probably will cost you maybe $20. Maybe. Only because of the Chipper Jones card. That's about it. And if you want to buy packs, the 93 Donrusses are typically in your $3 for $1 box at your local card shop. So you can find bargains galore left and right. And yeah, you're not going to be able to raise a ton of money if you hand collate this set and sell it. But that's okay, because that's not why you're doing it. You want a damn good product that is almost 30 years old, that is a nice piece of history with the two new expansion teams at that time, that has a great collection of young stars, established stars, and Hall of Famers, and it probably won't cost you more than $20-25, no matter how you put it together, to actually put it together. So 93 Donruss, highly recommend for those who are just looking for that 90s nostalgia itch to be scratched. Those who are looking for a nice collection of great players from the 1960s all the way up to players who only recently retired and got inducted into the Hall of Fame. It's all right there, all very affordable, very impressive looking, not too hard to find, and definitely will not break the bank. You could say that about a lot of early 1990s sets, but some of them have faults. 93 Donruss has very, very few. Again, the only knock, they didn't put Jeter in that set. Well, guess what? They weren't the only ones. But as for everything else, love the set. Not going to hand collate my own, but it was fun opening up some of these old packs, looking back at some of the players and going, yeah, I remember this one. I remember this one. And it was a fun few minutes. And nowadays, we all need a fun few minutes in our lives. Now, speaking of fun, here's one of my most favorite and fun moments of each podcast. Taking a look at some of the cards that we got in the packs and talking about some of the players that were featured on them. And one of them that stands out, a guy who was on top of the world entering into the 1993 baseball season. Yet in 1993, we would have no idea that he would still be plugging away, not only in Major League Baseball, but organized baseball in the mid-2000s. That's right. He still had a good 10, 12 years to go before finally hanging up his spikes and moving onto the coaching world. That after a brief hiatus going into just family life and ranch life. Talking about Pat Borders, the pride and joy of Lake Wales, Florida. Now, he wasn't born in Lake Wales. He was raised there. And I always chuckle at Lake Wales because I used to work many moons ago, mid-90s, I used to work at a Boy Scout summer camp that's located in Lake Wales. And my brothers and I, we ran the shooting sports complexes there. So for 3 summers, I taught archery and rifle shooting, basically advising kids how not to hurt themselves with those two items. And my older and younger brothers, they taught shotgun shooting. And I chuckle at Lake Wales because Lake Wales is truly a dot on the map. It is just one of those railroad junctions where highways 27, 17, and 60, and I believe Highway 98, they all intersect at some point in Lake Wales. And there's just not a whole hell of a lot to do there. There really isn't. And trust me, when you're working at a summer camp for 6 weeks in the Florida heat and humidity of June and July, you really, and you're 16, 17, 18 years old, you really understand how there's nothing to do there. There's just not a lot of things to do. So I'll just leave it at that, because some of the things that we did do involved bottles of liquid that we consumed and just general teenage chicanery that we got into. And I don't know what the statute of limitations is on some of those things we did. So I'll just leave it at that. But I chuckle because Pat Borders really helped make Lake Wales a popular town after he won the World Series MVP award in 1992. But that's going a little too far, isn't it? His family, his parents were teachers in Ohio. And they moved to Lake Wales in the 1970s. And that is where Pat Borders got his start. Although back then, even though he had a really good bat, he also had the old dreaded hands of stone. Nobody knew defensively where he could play because he didn't really excel anywhere. He did not handle the ball really well. But there's a great story from Rogers Sportsnet. That's a major sports channel up in Canada. They did a Catching Up with Pat Border story a couple years ago. Some great details there, and I'm going to lift a few of them from here. But Don Bridges, who was coaching the Lake Wales high school baseball team back in the 70s, was hearing rumors about how good of a hitter Borders was in Little League, that he was going to take a look at him, knew that he had a chance to succeed later on in life. But basically just at the plate. Again, defensively, they couldn't quite figure out exactly where he could play. But he played with tenacity, not just on the baseball diamond, but in other sports. He excelled in football. In fact, he was not only the quarterback, he was also the defensive end. And according to Bridges, Borders preferred being the defensive end over the quarterback because as defensive end, you got to hit people. So he was definitely a full contact guy. Likewise, Borders was a star for the high school basketball team who, if he was going to get called for a foul, he was going to make it worth his while. So this was a physical, active young man, had some very raw talent. Nobody could quite figure out exactly how that talent would be mined or how it would be used. But eventually it would get there, right? Right, of course. Now, it looked like football was going to be the future for Borders. In fact, he was graduating from Lake Wales in 1982, was all set to go to Mississippi State University on a football scholarship. And there was an idea that perhaps in addition to football, he could play baseball at MSU as well. But oops, something along the way interrupts his plans. That would be the amateur draft. The Blue Jays draft Borders in the summer of 1982. In fact, they drafted him in the sixth round. So all of a sudden, he's this high draft pick. And he figures, well, now's my chance. You know, baseball was his first love. He's like, I got to do this. So he goes from the balmy summers of Lake Wales, Florida, to the rather crisp days of Medicine Hat, Alberta, along with some other prospects drafted that year. You may have heard of these guys, Jimmy Key and David Wells. So Borders is moving his way up through the Blue Jays farm system. The problem is that, again, his bat is helping him, but his glove is really hurting him. In 1983, he is fielding a whopping 826, and the following year, 881 in low A Florence. So that's not looking too good. Plus, as the report points out, the Blue Jays nabbed Kelly Gruber off the Rule 5 draft from Cleveland. So you're starting to see the pieces fall in place around the infield. Now, keep in mind, I should have mentioned this before, because nobody knew exactly where to put him defensively. Borders was put in every situation. First base, third base, outfield, you name it. And finally, as the Blue Jays are trying to figure out what to make of this guy, because all of the other prospects that he was drafted with are fast-tracking through the Blue Jays system, and he's just kind of hanging around the low A levels. The Kinston Blue Jays, which were in high A, suggested, well, maybe you should be catcher. And of course, that doesn't sound right. Okay, this guy's got hands of stone and you want to make him a catcher? Are you kidding me? Well, it turned out that that was actually a very, very smart thing to do, as he was able to turn himself into a catcher and stay focused by having to catch a ball every pitch. Well, that's one way to get better, right? Practice, practice, practice. Well, if you're going to be handling every ball, you might as well learn how to catch it and defend it right. So he was able to become a catcher and very quickly start moving up his way through the Blue Jays farm system there. Now, an interesting side story here, while he was with the Knoxville Blue Jays, then a AA affiliate for the Blue Jays, and this would have been mid to late 80s, 86, I want to say. Think about some of the talent that the Blue Jays were pulling up through their system at that time. That was a pretty impressive team. And here's a fun side story. While in Knoxville, this is where Borders met his wife, Kathy, who was also an athlete. And they met in one of the most romantic places in Knoxville, Tennessee. Pizza Hut. Yeah. And here's the kicker. This is the ultimate underlining of minor league life. Borders was at this Pizza Hut cashing in a voucher he had won as part of a promotion. So he's there at Pizza Hut. He meets Kathy, who's also at Pizza Hut. And long story short, they would eventually get married and have 9 kids together. And again, because she was also an athlete, they complimented each other really well. So I thought that was a pretty fun story there. After AA, spends some time playing some Caribbean ball, is able to hone his craft, makes his major league debut in the late 1980s. And the rest, as they say, is history. Would win 2 World Series championships with the Blue Jays in 1992 and 93. As I mentioned, World Series MVP for the 92 World Series. Although as a rather shy guy, he didn't really want the credit of the World Series MVP. In fact, during the trophy celebration in Toronto that year, he said that he rather thought that the MVP trophy should go to the veterans who showed the way. That would be Dave Winfield and Jack Morris. After the 1994 season, as he's entering his early 30s, his play slipped just a little bit. He became more of a backup catcher rather than the number one catcher. And he started bouncing around a little bit. Played a few games in Kansas City, also Houston, St. Louis, the Angels, the White Sox, the Indians. And in 1999, it looked like he was going to be wrapping up his career with the Blue Jays as he signed on with them. But that wasn't the end of the story there, as Borders would sign that deal with the Blue Jays to be that veteran presence, not only in Toronto, but also their AAA club in Buffalo. Well, he got a chance to go to Sydney, Australia as a catcher with the U.S. Olympic baseball team, and was a star player there and a big mentor under Tommy Lasorda, the late Tommy Lasorda, we should say, as he was able to be part of that run down in Sydney. Now, after the Olympics in 2000, he would continue to bounce around a little bit, was part of the Devil Rays organization playing in Durham, North Carolina. Also was a veteran presence with the Seattle Mariners for several years, had a few games with the Minnesota Twins in 2004, back to Seattle at the age of 42, still caught 39 games in 2005, and yes, actually did sign a minor league agreement in 2006, but just wasn't able to keep up with the times. Granted, he was 43, so it was about that time to call it quits there. So after his major league debut in 1988, he was able to wrap things up in 2006. Now, at first, decided to kind of go the quiet retirement way. Went back to the family ranch in Lake Wales with his kids. Got to, you know, reestablish his connection with them. You know, it's tough being on the road as a ball player, so able to take some family time. But eventually was able to leave the ranch as the kids got older and started, you know, living their own lives. And he got into coaching. He was for several seasons the coach of the Williamsport Crosscutters, a low-level Philadelphia Phillies minor league affiliate. And now with the realignment, the restructuring of minor league baseball, or the more accurate description, the takeover and pillaging of minor league baseball by major league baseball. The Crosscutters are no longer part of minor league baseball, but Borders is still part of the Phillies organization, as he is now the manager of the Clearwater Threshers, the high A club of the Florida State League. Now, why does Pat Borders have any affiliation with the Phillies, a team that he never played for? Well, it all comes back to a GM who gave him a lot of rope to work with during his playing days, and that would be Pat Gillick, of course, the architect of those early 90s Toronto Blue Jays teams. Had many years of experience controlling things with the Philadelphia Phillies, and that is why Pat Borders is part of that organization and has been for several years. Plus, with his family still in Central Florida, not too far of a drive, not too big of a haul from Lake Wales to Clearwater, although there are far more things to do in Clearwater than Lake Wales. Now, we go from the story of Pat Borders, who had that 20-plus year run through Major League Baseball, the Olympic experience in 2000, is now managing a minor league team, to a player who you probably don't know, This is definitely a common card, but it is not a common person. And also, the 1993 Donruss card of this player is not very common. If you watch the video that I posted, you'll see that I'm just mesmerized by this great photograph of Sean Hare of the Detroit Tigers, basically at the plate, watching the ball come in and not swinging at it, because you can see the ball is about to cross the plate. So for Sean Hare's fate, I would hope that the ball was a little too high or a little too outside. But just to get that moment where the ball is maybe 8-10 inches coming off the plate and dropping down, and seeing the hand-eye coordination of this major league ball player watching this ball coming at the plate, it's just a great piece of photography. Now, there's not a lot of the story, or not a lot to the story of Sean Hare, I should say, as he was a utility player who had a very brief time in the major leagues. In fact, just a handful of games throughout several seasons, and some somewhat unforgettable or forgettable moments with the Korean professional baseball team, or league, I should say, the Haitai Tigers. But Sean Hare, as an outfielder and first baseman, was born in St. Louis, Missouri, March of 1967, and was signed by the Tigers as an undrafted free agent in August of 1988. He would work his way through the minor leagues, made his major league debut September 1991, and over the course of two seasons, 1991 and 92, he played in only 24 games. So you look at this 93 Donruss card, and this was the last glimmer of seeing Sean Hare in a Tigers uniform, patient at the plate, if ever. Placed on waivers, 1994, claimed by the rather hapless Mets. He appears in 22 games with the Mets, gets 9 hits, career highs for him. The following season, he signs with the Texas Rangers, appears in 18 games there, and that's it. His entire career in Major League Baseball amounts to a grand total of, I'm doing math here, 74 games. There we go. And he was in the minor league organizations of the St. Louis Cardinals and New York Yankees, and later the Tigers again through the 1997 season. Now, in 1998, he signs in Korea and supposedly became famous for some comments made before the season. One is, quote, which do you want, 300 or 30 home runs? Of course, 300, the batting average, 300, not 300 home runs. And supposedly, he was asked whether the ball should be hit over the fence or out of the whole stadium to be a home run. Well, supposedly, after having that conversation, he never hit a home run. And he also batted a whopping 206 in 1998. So while he was trying to endear himself to Korean baseball fans, he failed tremendously, and that pretty much ended his professional baseball career. Now, does that end the story of Mr. Hare? Absolutely not, because this is where he follows pretty much the same track as Kevin Moss. So even though Sean Hare appeared in 64 games, I said 74 later. I knew it was dangerous doing math, 64 games. Even though he only appears in 64 games, and even though this particular baseball card is probably not worth the cardboard it's printed on, Mr. Hare should not be laughed at, because after his professional career in baseball ended in 2000, he transitioned into the financial services industry. And he is currently the vice president of wealth management at Morgan Stanley Smith Barney in Sherman Oaks, California. Now, I've also seen, and this may be a little more of an updated part here, but he's also done some work with personal finance management with Wells Fargo. So again, you may look at your Sean Hare baseball cards and go, ah, damn, this isn't going to pay the mortgage. Well, Sean Hare, the financial advisor, can advise you what you can do with his baseball cards and how you can indeed pay the mortgage. All right, up next, a player who I have mocked a lot, and it's not because he's a bad person or a bad player. It's just spending much of my life in the Tampa Bay area he is not very well liked. Talking about Vinny Castilla, or as his birth name is, Vinicio Vinny Soraya Castilla. And there's a lot of good to the Vinny Castilla story, but there's also in Tampa Bay Rays history a lot of bad, which we'll get to in just a moment. First, the good, a standout baseball player growing up in Mexico, even though soccer is the dominant sport there, he was able to stand out in his home country, playing for the Saltillo Saraparo in the Mexican League, played there for 3 seasons, and was able to attract the attention of the Atlanta Braves in 1989. Now, he's also getting chased by the Dodgers and the Pirates and the Reds, but here he is, a guy that was going to be given some time to grow into his body and improve at the game. The Atlanta Braves offered the best opportunity, basically. So he signs with the Braves and basically says, you know what, I'll work on whatever position they throw me at. I'll work on improving my game. And he adjusts to life in America. He adjusts to life in the major or minor leagues, as any young Mexican would in Sumter, South Carolina in 1990. He's moving up through the Braves system. And even though there's a high ceiling for potential, take a look around the rest of the Atlanta Braves lineup in the early 1990s. Yeah, not too many places for a young man who is primarily an infielder to find work. Think about it. You had Jeff Treadway, you had Mark Lemke, you had Chipper Jones coming up. Terry Pendleton was still there. Sid Bream was still holding down first base. Just nowhere to go. So, understandably, the Braves left him exposed to the 1993 expansion draft, where the Colorado Rockies would pick him. Now, if you look at the 93 Donruss card, Castilla still featured in his Braves uniform here. So this is all you would see of Castilla in a Braves uniform until much, much later in his career. So he gets picked up by the Rockies, naturally finds a home at shortstop, splits time with the veteran Freddie Benavides, and was able to flourish just a little bit and start growing into a consistent everyday infielder. This despite the introduction of Walt Weiss into the lineup in 1994. So Castilla spends a little time in AAA before coming back to the majors as he replaces Charlie Hayes at third base. Gets a little help from a hitting instructor, Art Howell, for helping turn around his career at the plate. And throughout the mid to late 90s, Vinny Castilla becomes this goes from a talented, lots of potential utility player to pretty damn good third baseman and shortstop as well, so he could play there too. His best season, 1998, appeared in all 162 games, had 206 hits, 100 runs scored, 46 home runs, 144 RBI, and a batting average of .319. Second All-Star game as well, which was a nice plus considering the Rockies hosted the All-Star game in 1998, and he would continue to star with the Rockies in 1999. Now, Castilla would then be traded by the Rockies to the Tampa Bay Devil Rays for Rolando Araujo and Aaron Ledesma. Now, this trade, and I remember this, and I've talked before about the trade of Ben Grieve to the Devil Rays and how that was supposed to kind of ignite the team and show that the team was really going after some great talent. And let's also remember that the general manager of the Rays at that time, Chuck Lamar, was a longtime member of the management of the Atlanta Braves. So he knows all about Vinny Castilla and the upside. And going into the 2000 season, the Devil Rays, who were a decent expansion team, you know, they had mid-upper 60s win totals for their first 2 seasons. Well, they felt that they needed a little box office bang. They needed to start drawing fans to Tropicana Field. I know. It's strange. People aren't showing up to Tropicana Field. So they decide to open up the purse strings a little bit. Vince Namoli, then the owner of the team, says to Chuck Lamar, go out and get some big name players. We're going to, you know, build around offense, and people are going to watch a bunch of home runs get hit out of here. So Vinny Castilla was one of those acquisitions, as was Jose Canseco, as was Greg Vaughn. And then you still had Fred McGriff, who was part of the original team in 1998. These four players became what was known as the hit show. And I remember these corny radio jingles about the hit show. Hit show, Tampa Bay Devil Rays hit show. It was just really cheesy stuff. But you could understand why they were going to do it. And it served two purposes. One, Nemoli and Lamar were right. If you bring in a bunch of home run hitters in the American League, a rather homer-friendly ballpark, sure, why not entertain the fans? You know the team's going to lose 90 or so games a year. You might as well hit some dingers out, right? The other thing was, as the Rays at the time had some young prospects such as Rocco Baldelli, also Josh Hamilton, I believe they would soon draft Carl Crawford, you know, some of the young stars that they were eventually going to start bringing up into their system, including BJ Upton, among others. By having these veterans, these aging sluggers up on the team, you were able to keep your prospects in the minor leagues. No reason to bring them up to the major leagues and watch them get shelled. Well, unfortunately for the Devil Rays, these aging sluggers unfortunately aged a little too soon, and they were very ineffective. Fred McGriff's career was starting to slowly go downhill. Jose Canseco must have been in between cycles, not quite popping the ball out as much as he used to. Then you had Greg Vaughn, who was a slugger with the Brewers just a few years ago, just suddenly could not hit the ball to save his life. And then you had Vinny Castilla, who not only was having trouble at the plate as a hitter, but was dealing with numerous injuries and probably just did not like the situation. He had found a home in Colorado, was a star with the Rockies, now was just completely off the radar in Tampa Bay. So Vinny Castilla in Tampa Bay mockingly became known as Vinny Cash Stealer, because he was a high-priced slugger who definitely was not delivering on expectations, whether it was his fault or not. One thing I do recall, though, sitting in a game at Tropicana Field in the left field seats in, I believe it was the year 2000, Vinny Castilla clobbered a ball, quite possibly the longest home run I've ever seen in person. And he hit it right over the section that my friend and I were sitting in. We were probably three or four rows back from the fence. And you knew it right off the bat. It was coming your way. So you're standing up, and then you're just looking up and up, and you're tilting your head back. And then you're looking behind you. And normally what would be an impressive 380, 390-foot home run, as it turned out, I believe Castilla hit it like 468 feet. Now, there have been some other hits to left field, some other homers to left field that have surpassed that. But that was an absolute monster shot that went, I wouldn't say right over my head. The trajectory was over my head, but the ball itself was probably an additional 100 feet over my head as it was going to the back of the ballpark. So despite his blemishes in his brief time as a Devil Ray, I do recall being at a game where he just absolutely clobbered a ball to left field. And the only thing that kept it from going out of the ballpark was the wall at the back of the dome. Now, despite that, he was released by the Rays in May of 2001. The Houston Astros were able to pick him up, and then he starts his journey throughout the National League, not only with Houston, later signing a two-year contract with the Atlanta Braves, you know, able to split some time with Chipper Jones at third base. It was actually rather nice of Jones as he went out to the outfield for just a little bit. He would also sign later on with the Washington Nationals, gets traded to the San Diego Padres, and that was pretty much it for his major league career. Would, however, go back to Mexico and would be a key part of the World Baseball Classic of Team Mexico. He was the captain of the 2006 team, would later coach the Mexican team in world competitions, and has also become since then a very big advocate in organ donation and education about organ donation over the years following his playing days. He is also still very popular in Colorado, of course, and has also been a very big advocate of the Rockies, and he works in the front office for the Rockies and has been for quite a bit. Also has been inducted into the Latino Hall of Fame as well as the Colorado Sports Hall of Fame. So even though he is not well-liked in the Tampa Bay area, he is still very much loved, not only in Mexico, but certainly in the Colorado, Denver, Colorado area. Now, last but certainly not least, the story that I'm most excited to tell, because I was just absolutely floored by the story. And that is the story of Mike Heneman. Now, as I said earlier, as I'm opening these packs up and I see the Heneman card, I remember how incredible of a pitcher Mike Heneman was. And let me just read off some numbers for you from his days with the Detroit Tigers. Rookie season 1987, appears in 55 games, has an 11-3 record, 2.98 earned run average, 7 saves as well. 1988, 1.87 earned run average, 22 saves. 1989, American League All-Star, despite the 3.70 earned run average, 11-4 record for the season in 60 appearances. And would continue to have some pretty solid seasons, ERA either just above or just below a 3. Was the closer for several years, 1990 through 1993. And is still very highly ranked in a lot of the Detroit Tigers record books for his time there. And I'll tell you a little bit about some of the moves since then. But Mike Heneman is one of the most overlooked relief pitchers from the time. And, of course, when you're thinking of the early 90s, you think of Dennis Eckersley. You think of Lee Smith, maybe Tom Henke. There are certain closers that you think about. Trevor Hoffman's career was starting then, Troy Percival as well, Mariano Rivera, of course, a little later on in the 90s. But you don't think of Mike Heneman as a dominant closer. But Mike Heneman most definitely was. And as I mentioned, still very high up in the Tigers record books, second most saves, 154 in Tigers history, behind only Todd Jones. And if you just look at the stats, or you look at the Wikipedia summary, there's not a whole lot more to the Mike Heneman story, which is rather appropriate given the lack of coverage of how decent of a pitcher he was. So while doing a little research on him for this podcast, I found this great story from the Sporting News written by Ryan Fagan. This was a story that came out just a few months ago, back in October. And Fagan was doing a story about players who share his birthday or are from his own hometown of St. Charles, Missouri. And it turns out that even though Heneman was born in St. Charles, there's a whole lot more to the Heneman story that is just amazing. And Heneman decided to share this story, and I'm going to share it with you. So he was born at St. Joseph's Hospital, but was adopted by Bill and Shirley Heneman of St. Louis through the Catholic Charities of St. Louis. So they lived in the town of Festus, Missouri. And Mike Heneman grew up with his sister, Janet Heneman, who was also adopted. And as the writer of the story is probing here, Heneman's like, well, do you really want all of this information? He says, yeah. And Heneman spills the beans here. And here's the incredible story. Back in June of 2017, Heneman's wife, Meredith, encouraged him to learn a little more about his family history. So he takes one of those Ancestry.com DNA tests. So Heneman at first was a little hesitant. He knew he was adopted, but didn't really have much of a desire to kind of put his DNA out there and connect dots and do all that stuff. Well, he puts it out there and discovers a family that he had no idea about. He discovers the brothers and sisters that were part of his natural family. And the story of how he became separated from them is pretty interesting in that his birth father, Ed Hart, who again had a lot of kids, so like I said, there were seven siblings of the Henneman family. Ed Hart, the father, had an affair, and according to family lore, it was an affair with a woman that he worked with, and that created Mike Henneman. So despite the affair and the hardship and the heartbreak that comes with this, Ed and Marilyn, his wife, decide they're going to work through it. They're going to stay together, but the baby was going to be put up for adoption. So they put Mike up for adoption, and just days after his birth, he's adopted by the Henneman family. Like I said, he found out at a rather young age that he was adopted. At the time, didn't really mean much to him. The Hennemans explained, you know, what adoption was and you know, how, you know, parents will give birth to children and can't, for whatever reason, raise them, so they allow other adults to raise them. And that was pretty much it. And the Henneman family raised him. He becomes a star pitcher, was sought after by a lot of major league teams, actually. In fact, he was drafted three times. First by the Toronto Blue Jays in 1982. So Henneman almost became a draft mate, a teammate of Pat Borders, believe it or not. He decides to turn that down. Drafted again by the Phillies in 1983, also turns that down. Drafted by the Tigers in 1984, he decides to go ahead and accept that offer. And why not? Because everything that he needed to do in college, he was already able to take care of. College, by the way, would be Oklahoma State, where he helped Oklahoma State to two College World Series trips during his time there. In fact, he's a member of the Oklahoma State Baseball Hall of Fame, inducted there in 1993. And he just goes on living his baseball life. You know, he's drafted by the Tigers, works his way up through their system, becomes an all-star pitcher, hell of a reliever there too. And as the Tigers start pulling the team apart in 1995, he is traded to Houston for Phil Nevin. Later, granted free agency, signs with the Texas Rangers in 1995, and ends his playing career with Texas. So 1987 to 1996, hey, 10 seasons. Got to play in 561 games, career earned an average 3.21, 193 saves. Pretty solid showing there, able to retire at the age of 34. And you think, well, Mike Henneman can just kind of go the way of every other former ball player. And since then, he's become part of a roving minor league instructor. So, you know, he did kind of follow that path. But again, takes that DNA test, discovers the backstory of Ed Hart, who has an affair, fathers him, then they have to put him up for adoption. And now he's starting to discover a little more about his family. And the amazing thing is that Mike Henneman, and if you look at the story from the Sporting News, they put pictures of Henneman as a player next to a picture of his father, his birth father, Ed Hart. And the two are practically alike. Like they just have the same facial structure, jaw structure, hair color, eyes, you name it. And this is one of the great stories of Mike Henneman finding these additional family members who live not too far away from Henneman, by the way. Henneman, you know, still lives in Missouri, and a lot of these family members are in the Cincinnati area. So, you know, they meet him, and, you know, these kids, his brothers and sisters that he had no idea about, they look at him and they're just like, holy cow, you look just like Dad. And they're just absolutely floored by how much he looks like him. And to make a very long story short here, the Hennemans and the Harts have become very close together, have actually planned on going to Ireland for a little bit of ancestor searching and digging. Of course, COVID has curbed those travel plans. And another interesting thing about all this is that Mike Hanneman has learned what his birth name is. He is not actually Michael. No, his birth name is James. James Edward Sullivan Jr. And according to adoption papers given to him by his mother, his stepmother. He actually went by the name Jimmy for several months when he was an infant. So he's learned about these family members. He's learned about his past life. He's learned about extended family. So, for example, one of his sister's kids has played not only college baseball, but professional baseball, was actually a draft pick of the White Sox and played in their organization for a couple of years. And it's just a really heartwarming story. So when I post, and I normally do this, I'll post a tweet about some of the individual stories that we talk about on the program. When I post that, I will add the link to that Sporting News story, because you've got to read it. You know, me telling you about it is just not going to do it justice. But how Mike Hanneman, who, you know, in the social language, he was a mistake. Mike Hanneman, who was mercifully put up for adoption, raised in a great family, was very talented, had a very productive baseball playing career, is a coach now. He was able to connect to his birth family, learn so much about the birth family, learn about himself and these brothers and sisters that he had no knowledge about for over 50 years, finally get to meet him and are able to look at him and his mannerisms and see in him their father. And that was just mind-blowing and beautiful at the same time. So once again, folks, there may be common cards, but there are no common players and very few common stories. So if you're going through your card collection and you find something from the late 80s or early to mid 90s with Mike Hanneman, just know that, yeah, that may be valued at 3 cents in your Beckett baseball card guide. But there's so much more to the story of Mike Hanneman or any of these other players that we were talking about. Sean Hare, a common card, but now a financial advisor. Pat Borders, the shy kid who had hands of stone, but who was able to, through tenacity and hard work, turn it into a 24-year career as a player in baseball. And even Vinny Castilla, no, not Vinny Cash Stealer, Vinny Castilla, who scouts had no idea what he was going to do 30 years ago, turned out to be a very popular player for the Rockies, an all-star infielder, and much beloved in his home country of Mexico. So just remember that as you're going through those stacks of cards. And before you go, who's this? Whatever. A lot of interesting stories behind a lot of these players. And some interesting cards from an interesting set. 93 Donruss, again, not going to break the bank by any stretch of the imagination. You can get boxes for anywhere $10 to $20 a pop, Series 1 or Series 2. Series 2 is slightly more expensive because of the Chipper Jones card that is in there, but nothing that's really going to hurt you. In fact, the Chipper Jones card, I read somewhere, PSA 10 book value is about $25. So that again tells you, you're not going to make a mint off this set. You're actually going to spend more time trying to certify that that card is a PSA 10 than actually selling it as a PSA 10. So you can get a wide swath of young stars like Chipper Jones through some outstanding young players at that time, established stars and Hall of Fame players, for not a whole lot. Whether you're buying those boxes for 10, 15, 20 bucks, or you're getting that hand collated set on eBay for two with $12 shipping or $15 shipping, whatever it was, you can go ahead and scratch that 90s nostalgia itch with an outstanding set. Boy, what a sharp set, and not slathered in UV coating. Yes, there's a gloss to it, but the cards generally will not stick to one another. So feel free to buy some of those packs, get some of those boxes, unload some junk wax from your favorite local card shop. They will thank you profusely later, and you will be honored and awarded with a pretty nice solid 792 card set, plus perhaps some of those inserts, those chase cards, maybe an autograph card, maybe a Legends of the Game card, perhaps some of those glossy Donruss Diamond Kings as well. So that wraps up our look at 93 Donruss. Again, two shows from now. So that will be our first show in February. We'll wrap up our look at all of those early 90s Donruss sets with a 1994. We'll take care of that then. Next program, January 29th, we're taking a look at the Topps Heads Up collection. Again, a very unique, kind of an oddball collection. Topps made it for the right reasons. It's just for reasons out of their control, they had to kill it. But it's a unique thing from 1990. If you can track some down from 1989, that will perhaps pay your mortgage for a month. I'll have the details of that in our next show. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. Cash donations can be made paypal.me/waxecstatic. Cardboard donations, if you're interested, reach out first. Let me know what you're thinking. mattsalmonsays@gmail.com. And of course, rating and reviewing the podcast, always appreciated as well. Do you know what's also appreciated? Taking care of yourself and others. Folks, we're in the dregs of this pandemic. Please put your politics aside, put your ego aside, put your manly manless aside. Just put on the damn mask, wash your hands, stay socially distant, and please do your part to, you know, mitigate this before you get the vaccine. Vaccines are on the way. They're coming, but you don't want to be the soldier killed after the battle has been won. Okay. Wear those masks, wash those hands, and be a few feet apart from each other and do it. If not for everyone else, do it for yourself because you're a selfish bastard. And if that's what it takes for you to do it, by all means, do it. Okay. We'll see you 2 weeks from now, January 29th, with a little heads up from Topps from 1990. I'm Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Take care and thanks for listening.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.